own collective journey. We look out into the distance and imagine peaks and valleys, steel ourselves for the hard work it will take to get to our destination, and we take comfort in knowing that artists from every generation have experienced the same feelings. Along the trail, we might see the hoof prints and wagon ruts, cairns and arrows of those who have gone before us, marking the way forward and pointing us in the right direction. And when we find ourselves in new, uncharted territory, with precious little signposting and no clear path in sight, it is then that we must lead with love and beauty and faith. You bet your booth. We join Executive Director Seth Hopkins for an exclusive tour of the award-winning Booth Western Art Museum. Where do you find the best art museum in the country? Not just the best Western museum, the best art museum, period. New York? Chicago? L.A.? It might surprise you to learn that in the recent USA Today 10 Best Reader's Choice Awards, the Booth Western Art Museum in Cartersville, Georgia, ranked number one. The Booth was nominated alongside such prestigious museums as the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, the Chicago Art Institute, and the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C. For us to beat out so many well-known museums is amazing. Nationally, we are probably the least known museum on the entire list, so it's a win that is kind of like slaying 19 Goliaths all at the same time, says Booth Museum Executive Director Seth Hopkins. The award comes just as the Booth Museum is celebrating the 20th anniversary of its founding by an anonymous local family in July 2000. The museum has welcomed almost 1 million visitors since it opened in 2003 and became an affiliate of the Smithsonian Institution. You'll find the 120,000-square-foot museum just north of Atlanta, in the historic town of Cartersville. Its collection includes significant historic works and major examples of the best of living artists, those working in historical realism and those on the cutting edge of the more contemporary art of the West. It's a great overview of what has been going on in Western art over the past 50 years, Hopkins says. Visitors are invited to see America's story through the contemporary Western artwork, a presidential gallery, a Civil War art gallery, and an interactive children's gallery called Sagebrush Ranch. We hope Western fans from around the world will come and enjoy what we've created and find out why we were recognized as one of the great art museums in America, Hopkins says. In the meantime, we've asked Hopkins to give CNI readers an exclusive tour highlighting a dozen of the most beloved pieces in the Booth's collection. Deborah Copenhaver Fellows, American, born 1948, Giving Thanks, 2006, bronze, 156x51x138 inches. The first piece you see when you walk onto our manicured grounds is this monumental bronze by Deborah Copenhaver Fellows. She is Western royalty, the daughter of legendary bronc rider Deb Copenhaver, the sister of former world champion roper Jeff Copenhaver, and the wife of multi-award-winning cowboy artist Fred Fellows. Yet, she has established her own formidable identity in the art world through a wide variety of bronze creations that run the emotional gamut from evoking belly laughs to jerking tears. She has sculpted several war memorials and is currently working on a sculpture to honor the 19 Granite Mountain hotshots killed in the deadly Yarnell Hill fire in Arizona in 2013. One of the great thrills of my career was being present for the unveiling of Fellow's depiction of Barry Goldwater for Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol. And I experience a quiet thrill whenever I pass this meditative bronze as I approach the museum entryway. The sculpture depicts a cowboy on horseback, hat off, head bowed. It honors Fellow's father through her most vivid childhood memories when he was a rodeo producer and would be the last to ride into the arena during the grand entry. A spotlight would hit him, and he would pray for the safety of the cowboys and the cowgirls, as well as the stock. The full title of the bronze is Giving Thanks for the Rain, the Grass, and a Way of Life. Its powerful message is amplified by its placement near the cornerstone for a church that formerly occupied the museum site. The original church building had grown too small for the congregation and had significant asbestos issues. The anonymous founders of the booth reached a more than fair deal with the church, allowing them to move to a larger piece of land and grow, just like the metaphorical grass referred to in the title of the bronze. Henry Jackson, American, 1924 to 2011. The Range Burial, 1958. Bronze, 16 by 22 by 44 inches. As we enter the building, we are greeted by two major murals on a long-term loan from the Buffalo Bills Center of the West, created by Harry Jackson, who is much better known as a sculptor. Looking more closely, you will indeed see each mural has a corresponding bronze sculpture in front of it. The rest of the story is in a moment. But first, let's go back in time to 1999, when we were all worried about Y2K. My Y2K moment was when the founder of the booth, for whom I had worked for 10 years, walked into my office to inform me that he was selling the company, planned to build an art museum, and that I would be running it. At that point, I had little art background and no museum experience, but he told me to take advantage of the 2 to 3 years it would take to build the building to get out and learn something about Western art. We took regular trips to museums, galleries, artists, studios, auctions, and elsewhere to gather art and ideas as part of my crash course in art appreciation. One of the first stops we made was at the R.M. Norton Art Gallery in Shreveport, Louisiana. It was there that I first encountered this sculpture, the Range Burial. It stopped me in my tracks and gave me a powerful emotional jolt as I stood transfixed. Having a relatively few art encounters, it was a new and strange feeling for me. I wondered how often it happens to people in the art world. For me personally, it happened maybe 15 times in the last 20 years. When a cast of the Range Burial came up for auction, it was one of the few times I've overstated my case to the board that we must own this piece. Luckily, it did not sell for anywhere near what it should have been worth. Jackson had originally created the bronze as a way to work out the figure group for a mural, and did the same with the corresponding bronze and mural called the Stampede. Shortly after our acquisition, we found out the murals might be available for loan. The artist's last public appearance before his death in 2011 was at the unveiling at the booth in 2009. John Coleman, American, born 1949. Caitlin Bodmer Series, 2004 to 2011. Bronze, dimensions vary, average 34 inches high. Two of the first works you see on entering our permanent collection galleries are paintings from the 1830s by George Catlin. Owned by the Smithsonian American Art Institute, we've had them on long-term loan for many years. They constitute one of the art historical bookends in our galleries. The other is this series of tin bronze created by John Coleman over a 7-year period. Coleman studied all the information he could find on the works of Catlin and one of his contemporaries, the Swiss artist Karl Bodmer. Scouring their paintings, sketches, and descriptions, Coleman sought to determine the 10 most interesting-looking individuals they ever encountered. Not the most powerful chiefs or the most well-known, but the most distinctive physically. In some cases, Lewis and Clark had met the same individuals as young men and also commented on their appearance. In our opinion, this series represents one of the greatest achievements in Western sculpture since the death of Remington in 1909. The combination of historical research, attention to detail, compositions, and the power of all 10 being presented together as they are displayed at the booth gives the group a very strong presence. W.R. Lay, American, 1866 to 1955. Dangerous Trail, 1914. Oil on canvas, 60 by 40 inches. While the Booth Museum seeks to mainly collect the best living artists working in the Western genre, we have also acquired some important pieces from the historic period to lend depth to the collection and add context to the work of the living artists we highlight. One of the more important works in the collection is this action scene set in a canyon called The Dangerous Trail by William Robinson Lee, also known as W.R. In his book about his travels in the West, Lee mentions this type of accident happening with some regularity, and once a horse was unloaded, they would often upright themselves and be no worse for wear. This expedition now seems doomed, though, since the coffee pot is long gone. Lee was known in his lifetime as the Sagebrush Rembrandt. A West Virginian by birth, he was both a painter and illustrator. He is best known for his paintings of the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone National Park, as well as the Hopi and Navajo Indians, who were among his favorite subjects. He was a contemporary of Remington and Russell, yet he is not nearly as well known to the public. My theory is that he actually lived too long, not passing until 1955 at the age of 89, and that he was hardly mentioned in the early books of Western art introduced in the 1950s because he was either still alive or had only recently passed. Maynard Dixon, American, 1875 to 1946. Red Butte with Mountain Men, 1935. Oil on canvas, 96 by 214 inches. In the largest of the permanent collection galleries, we are nearly overwhelmed by the presence of Red Butte with Mountain Men, an 8 by 18 foot painting by Maynard Dixon. He created 2 murals this size in 1935 for a restaurant in San Francisco called the Kit Carson Grill. This gives us a clue as to who these men might be, perhaps the legendary scout Kit Carson leading a pack train through southern Utah. The artist maintained a home and studio there in Mount Carmel. This rock formation has never been identified as any specific place. Rather, it seems to have sprung from Dixon's mind, having natural geologic features focused with elements of cubism. The companion painting, a horseback portrait of Carson, has been on long-term loan to Scottsdale's Museum of the West for many years. Dixon is one of the few artists who could attract the attention of both Western collectors and those seeking modernism, thus driving his importance in both art history and at auction ever higher. He is also a hero for a legion of artists in the contemporary generation who idolize his work and seek to emulate it to one degree or another. Ed Dwight, American, born 1933. Dirt Farmers, 1980. Bronze, 22 by 14 by 8 inches. One of the goals of the Booth Western Art Museum is to convey the idea that the history of the American West is not just white guys on white horses with white hats. Rather, that it was a very diverse environment where people were so few and far between, they had no choice but to rely on each other, despite thoughts of discrimination. In our collections, we have works by Native Americans, African Americans, Chinese Americans, and many more works by women artists than in most other Western museums. That is not to say we're better. It has more to do with our collection being newer and more closely reflecting the diversity of artists and subjects found in the contemporary Western art scene versus 100 or more years ago. Ed Dwight was the first black astronaut candidate. If JFK had lived to serve two full terms, Dwight may well have walked on the moon. But after Kennedy's death, President Lyndon B. Johnson asked him to step down to make way for his own black candidate. Dwight resigned from the Air Force several years later. An engineer, he had successful careers as a land developer and restaurateur before he took up sculpture relatively late in life. He has gone on to create well over 100 monuments and more than 18,000 smaller-scale bronze gallery pieces. This particular work is based on his grandparents from Dalton, Georgia, former slaves who went west and homesteaded in Kansas City, Kansas. The Booth was introduced to this work when a cast was loaned to an exhibition we organized called The Black West, Black Cowboys, Buffalo Soldiers, and Untold Stories. Following that show, we acquired a number of pieces that now allow us to tell those stories that had gone untold for too long. Howard Turkning, American, born 1927. River Crow, 2000. Gouache on paper, 40 by 24 inches. As we enter the First People's Gallery, honoring Native Americans, we encounter many works by the most well-known Western artists of the previous 50 years. G. Harvey, Joe Beeler, Roy Anderson, Ken Riley, and at 65, the relative youngster, Martin Grell. At one end of the gallery are three works by Howard Turkning, the most awarded and highly prized artist of this generation. A native Chicagoan, Turkning became enamored of the West and Native Americans at age 15, when he camped and fished with a cousin for a summer near Durango, Colorado. He served as a U.S. Marine during peacetime, but developed some of his empathy for Native peoples while serving as a civilian combat artist in Vietnam. The three Turkning pieces, River Crow, Gouache, Trail Along the Backbone, Oil, and On the Brink, Charcoal and Acrylic, cover 15 years of his career in three different media. It's a unique installation and one we're lucky to have. River Crow depicts tribal members of a subgroup of the Crow Nation and their reflections in the water on a double entendre of the title. Turkning uses of gouache in this painting harkens back to the days when he was a young illustrator working in the studio Haddon Sunbloom and his subsequent career as an incredibly successful movie poster artist. Turkning's images for Gone with the Wind and The Sound of Music are two of the most remembered in movie history. He used this opaque water-based medium to achieve the look of oil with an immediacy and quick drying quality of watercolor. Martin Grell, American, born 1954. Running with the Elk Dogs, 2007. Oil on linen, 48 by 60 inches. The Booth Museum recently recognized Martin Grell with this Artist of Excellence Award. This is only the second time the museum has awarded this prize, the other honoree being sculptor John Coleman last year. Previously, the museum had honored artists such as Howard Terpening and Glenna Goodacre with Lifetime Achievement Awards. Several years ago, the decision was made to focus on mid-career artists rather than those who might be nearer the end of their career. A longtime member of the prestigious Cowboy Artists of America, the much-awarded Grell hails from Clifton, Texas, where he continues to live on a ranch in Boss County, an area settled by hard-working Norwegian and German immigrants, and now home to several other important Western artists. This painting by Grell is somewhat atypical, not featuring water nor a mountainous landscape. Instead, the action is set on the fearless prairies, where the Plains Indians got their first look at wild horses. Legend suggests the Blackfeet described the first horses as they saw as looking somewhat like elk, being about the same size and color, while others thought of them as bigger versions of dogs that were used to pull the travois loaded with their belongings, so they called them elk dogs. Bill Hughes, American, 1932 to 1992. Canyon Passage, 1991, oil on canvas, 74 by 65 inches. When the Lean and Tree Corporation in Longmont, Colorado, announced it was closing its art museum and would be selling the contents, the Booth became quite uninterested in several works. Through discussions with the wonderful Trumbull family, we were able to acquire three pieces for our collection, allowing them to continue to be available for the public. We added the sculpture Cosmos by Harry Jackson, the painting Oregon Pioneers by Gary Ernest Smith, and this work, Canyon Passage by Bill Hughes, to our permanent collection. While these three were not the most valuable pieces in that collection, from an interpretive standpoint, they are certainly three of the most important. Hughes is a highly underappreciated landscape artist who often incorporated wildlife or cowboy elements. An Ohio native, he lived for a time in Los Angeles and Santa Fe, finally settling with his wife in an art colony near Scottsdale, Arizona. He was a proponent for a painting style he called actualism, a technique designed to draw the viewer onto the scene so that they could imagine themselves moving through the landscape, which you can truly experience in this scene. Visitors to the Lean and Tree Museum routinely listed this work as their favorite. In the relatively short time it has been in our collection, it has certainly stopped many visitors in their tracks. Hughes often said he preferred not to work from photographs, relying on his memory to conjure up scenes in his mind that might include slices of many locations stitched together to resemble reality. In this work, it is his masterful handling of the light and the drama implied that most attracts visitors to stand before it and become immersed. Kim Douglas Wiggins, American-born, 1959, Eve of St. Francis, Ranchos de Taos, 2003. Oil on canvas, 60 by 76 inches. Another of the collecting goals of the Booth Western Art Museum is to collect not only the best of the living realist artists, but also those employing more contemporary styles over the same time period. This work by Kim Wiggins was created in a contemporary style, yet conveys many layers of history. It speaks to the multiculturalism evident in the Southwest, especially in Wiggins' native New Mexico. He was born near Roswell, in the areas around Santa Fe and Taos. Wiggins has inserted himself into the composition as the cowboy in the foreground on the left. To his right is the famed Taos Society of Artists, founding member painter Ernest Blumenschein, shown as the priest, who has ceremonially passed the candle of inspiration from his generation of artists to the next. The scene filling the background is the Eve of St. Francis feast, when American Indians were urged to bring their animals to the Catholic mission, such as the one seen in the painting in Ranchos de Taos, perhaps the most painted church in America. Wiggins explains that this is one of the areas where the native people quickly latched onto the teachings of the missionaries, who would not want to bring their animals to be blessed with prayers offered from their safety and productivity. One of the leading painters in the contemporary Western art, Wiggins is known for modern and fresh-looking expressionistic landscapes. Yet, in this work, his contemporary vision has deep historical roots in the American West and works created 100 years ago by artists such as Thomas Hart Benton, Maynard Dixon, and several artists associated with the Taos Society of Artists. Fritz Scholder, American, Native American, Luseno, 1937 to 2005. Indian at a Gallup bus stop, 1969. Oil on canvas, 40 by 30 inches. Fritz Scholder is arguably the most important Native American painter in our history, although he often rejected that description, being only about one quarter indigenous. A giant among contemporary artists, he was born in Minnesota and became one of the earliest instructors at the Institute of American Indian Art in Santa Fe in the 1960s, teaching some of the most talented early students to ever come out of the renowned school. Scholder sought to convey the contemporary Native American experience as a somewhat tortured one by including figures with contrived facial features, dressed in modern clothing, juxtaposed with modern intrusions such as the arcade game seen in this work. Created in the same vein as other early works, particularly Indian with a Beer Can, Super Indian No. 2, and Indians with Umbrellas, this painting juxtaposes a Native American wearing a mix of traditional Native and so-called cowboy clothes, trying to live with a foot in both worlds, traditional indigenous and the white man's world. In my opinion, this painting is one of the most important acquisitions the museum has made in recent years. If requests to borrow a painting are an indication of importance, this one certainly wins the prize, as it has been traveled the most of any of the works in our collection. Donna Howell Sickles, American-born, 1949. Not Without Its Ups and Downs, 2001. Mixed media, pastel and charcoal on paper, 60 by 40 inches. Another leading artist in contemporary Western art is Donna Howell Sickles. Raised on a 900-acre farm in North Texas and transplanted to New Mexico from junior high through high school, she returned to the Lone Star State for college. It was in the final year of working on her BFA at Texas Tech that Sickles got an old postcard from a fellow art student showing a cowgirl circa 1935 seated on a horse. The caption read, "Greetings from a real cowgirl from the old Southwest." Although Sickles had grown up on a farm and ranching operation, she hadn't considered herself Western, but this image spoke to her. Inspired by what she had thought was fictional imagery, Sickles later found out her inspirations were real rodeo contestants and performers, and they became iconic in her work. She has since created a body of work depicting women who are independent, strong, hopeful, and loving life, which is also how Sickles describes herself. Her works make you smile, but the more you ponder their metaphorical elements, the more you'll likely determine there's more going on than meets the eye. I once joked with an artist about this particular work, that the cowgirl, straddling an enormous bull with sharp horns, looked awfully happy for somebody about to be thrown to her death. She is not being thrown to her death, Sickles said. She's merely dealing with the ups and downs of daily life. A wonderful image to take away from our tour, highlighting just 12 of the nearly 600 story-filled works on view at the booth. Dramatic Duo. Diane Lane and Kevin Costner set out on a dangerous western journey in the gripping new thriller Let Him Go by Joe Layden. Call Let Him Go a slow-burn thriller, and you won't be far off the mark. Indeed, the fuse is lit as early as the opening scenes, during which even the commonplace activities of a daily routine feel infused with a sense of unease, if not dread. George, Kevin Costner, and Margaret Blackledge, Diane Lane, appear at ease with each other in the kitchen of their 1950s Montana farmhouse, tending to morning chores. But there is unmistakable tension between Margaret and Lorna, Kaylee Carter, her daughter-in-law, whom she criticizes for being insufficiently attentive to her infant son, Margaret's grandson. And while their son James, Ryan Bruce, seems confident and competent as he sets out on a ride around their spread, Margaret and George immediately fear the worst when his horse returns without him. Sure enough, when George rides out to find him, he finds his son dead. The result of a tragic accident. Flash forward 3 years or so, Lorna marries Donnie Waboy, Will Britton, a seemingly rootless fellow who obviously doesn't impress George and Margaret. Still, the Blackledges do their best to remain on good terms with the younger couple, if only for the sake of their grandson. Even when Margaret sees Donnie mistreating little Jimmy, played alternately by Bram and Otto Hornig, and striking Lorna, she says nothing to George, who, not incidentally, just happens to be a retired sheriff. But then comes the day when Donnie, Lorna, and Jimmy move out of their apartment without alerting the Blackledges and head off to points unknown. At first, George responds with typical stoicism. Sometimes that's all life is, Margaret, a list of what we've lost. But Margaret won't be appeased so easily. One way or another, with George's help or not, she will pursue the younger couple and reunite with her grandson. Keep this in mind. All of what you've just read is simply the setup for Let Him Go, a gripping drama that slowly, steadily builds suspense as the Blackledges track their grandson to an off-the-grid household in the Dakotas that is ruled with a whim of iron by Blanche Weboy, Leslie Manville, a fiercely insular matriarch with implacable ideas about family ties, and a group of offspring ready and eager to do her bidding. After a certain point in the film, the audience can't help worrying that something terrible may happen at any moment, unless something worse happens first. When bad things ultimately do happen, they come as shocks, but not surprises. Based on an acclaimed novel by Larry Watson, Let Him Go is a striking change of pace for writer-director Thomas Bishuda, whose previous credits include Big Eden, 2000, a sweet-natured romantic comedy about a gay New York artist, Ari Gross, who finds his neighbors are surprisingly supportive when he returns to his small Montana hometown, and The Family Stone, 2005, a well-received dramedy in which an uptight Manhattan executive, Sarah Jessica Parker, is thrown out of her comfort zone by the rambunctiously bohemian parents, Diane Keaton and Craig T. Nelson, and family of her fiancé, Dermot Mulroney. More important, it's also a showcase for another exceptional performance by the formidably versatile Diane Lane, whose credits range from teenage roles opposite Laurence Olivier, A Little Romance, Burt Lancaster, Cattle Annie and Little Britches, and Kenny Rogers, Six Pack, to demanding adult parts in such films and dramas as Unfaithful, Under the Tuscan Sun, Secretariat, and, of course, the epic miniseries Lonesome Dove. We caught up with Lane by phone during the pandemic lockdown to talk about her compelling performance as a woman driven to extremes to save her grandson in Let Him Go. Here are some highlights from our conversation. Whenever an actor plays a role as emotionally demanding as Margaret Blackledge, they must really have a lot of trust in their director, so they'll know they're in safe hands as they take risks. How did Thomas Bruschetta earn your trust? Great question. In this case, I could see evidence of emotional intelligence in his previous work. I thought, oh wow, he's got a tremendous amount of heart, and I bet he's going to bring that to whatever story appeals to him next. I feel like he is a wonderful student of humaneness. And when we met, I could see he's so well-spoken and he's so well-read. I have had experiences in the past where I just adore a director in terms of being in their presence. But then when you're working under them, a whole other character comes out on the film set. Once they don the leadership cap, for some reason, other elements of their personality come out. But I will say that Tom remained like a stoic angel, guarding the priorities of our story getting on film. You were working on a tight schedule and a limited budget. Did that place additional pressure on you during production? Every experience has its obstacle course. In hindsight, it's always a miracle that a film gets made. Sometimes daily, it's a miracle. I mean, while we were filming up in Calgary, the weather changed every 30 minutes or so, and we had a lot of outdoor stuff to film. That's true for Texas as well, and when we did Lonesome Dove there, we had a lot of the same problems. But Tom made it easier because he's somebody that, well, George C. Wolfe, who I worked with on Nights in Rodant, 2008, was another director that I felt this way about. I would serve coffee on the set just to be near them. I mean, they have such a beneficent aura about them and an inclusiveness. And that's so important on a film. When you accomplish both leadership and inclusion, it's not always the case. So it was just a wonderful experience. Whatever the fate of the movie, it was just a gift to do it. You and Kevin Costner developed such a wonderful chemistry together that it's easy to believe you as a long married couple with decades of shared experiences. There are many examples of this throughout Let Him Go, but there's an especially funny and telling scene where he buys a small bottle of whiskey and he immediately indicates he doesn't want to be nagged about it. And while Margaret is wise enough not to nag, it's crystal clear that she disapproves. Well, sometimes you don't have to be the one to say anything. As we depict in our scene, there's clearly a historical reference to a drinking issue, and he just says he appreciates not getting a lecture. I suppose that's progress for a couple that's been dealing with each other and their secrets over several decades. For her, she doesn't have to say a word. He knows exactly what she would be saying. That's the benefit of a long-term relationship. You can just look at each other and pretty much know how the other one feels about most things. There is a quiet intimacy that long-term relationships benefit from. As far as chemistry goes, I know that's a term that is bandied about a lot, but it was definitely there between me and Kevin. We had the pleasure of being friends from Man of Steel in 2013, and I just knew he was going to have to come back for Batman and Dawn of Justice, 2016, even though his character had passed into the great beyond. But I'm happy to hear you say you noticed the chemistry here. I know I felt it while we were filming. But it's funny, because sometimes you can feel it and it won't be conveyed to the camera. It's the strangest phenomenon I've ever experienced. I mean, it's like sometimes when you're doing a love scene, you feel like you're giving so much and you're connected and sharing and letting the camera in, but then you see it on film and it doesn't convey. And then other times, it feels like cardboard while you're doing it, and the sparks are flying on the screen. So there's still a mysterious element that is intangible and not under the actor's control, believe it or not. But still, even though the two of you are evenly matched here, you could make an argument that you are the movie's protagonist. George reluctantly goes along with you. Reluctantly, that is, probably because he's a retired lawman, and he knows how family squabbles like this can turn out. And he comes through when the chips are down. Yet Margaret is the one who truly drives the story and her husband with her obsession, for better or worse. Maybe. But categorizing someone as a protagonist is like trying to find the first domino in the line. Here you have the dance of a husband trying to bring peace to his wife's heart. I mean, one person in a relationship can comprehend loss and be able to go forward in life with a modicum of peace, whereas the other person cannot achieve peace with that loss. I mean, clearly, she's projected onto the grandchild the loss of her son. So the grandchild embodies a connection to her dead son, and rightfully so. But I also feel that the generosity of heart that Kevin possesses in himself makes him perfect for his character, because of the level of sacrifice, the level of commitment George has. You do quite a bit of writing in Let Him Go, which you haven't done in many other films. In fact, except for Cattle Annie and Little Britches and Lonesome Dove, which were westerns, we haven't seen you in the saddle much at all. That's true, and it's always an interesting situation, because whenever you have an actor on a horse, you have to insure them for the entire value of the project. I mean, they could continue filming if, God forbid, the director became unwell or something. But if one of your actors has an accident and can't film, you've really screwed the pooch. So you really have to practice, because by insurance company standards, anything you do with a horse, anytime you ride a horse, is considered a stunt. They figure that's a lot of power underneath your leading lady. They consider just being near a horse a stunt in terms of insurance. In fact, sometimes you practice what you're going to be doing in the film, and then you get to the set and they say, "Oh, no, actually, we're not going to let you run on the horse." And you're like, "What do you mean? I'm all polished and proud, and I can jump off the saddle and do what's asked of me." It's disappointing, but you realize it's a very rare circumstance where an actor is allowed to do very much on a horse. And it's funny, what constitutes a stunt on a set is not necessarily what you imagine it to be. But you managed to ride tall here. You know, if you're going to shoot a film in Calgary, you can be 80% sure there are horses involved in the story. And everybody giggles, and it's sweet, and it's just the way it is, because the landscape and the beauty around that area is still available in its natural form to film. In this case, I was happy to see that the lady who would really do the riding in the wide shots was Jerry Deuce. My hat is off to her for the rest of my days. I mean, she's just an epic stunt rider. I think she was the first woman to get into the Cowboy Hall of Fame, and she teaches the craft that she practices. She became friends with me because she was the one who would practice riding with me. I had such a ball knowing what she was capable of. I mean, it was like taking a Ferrari and going around the block with her, because she's capable of so much. It's so funny. I would get to do something that I'd practiced, but I would only get to do it twice on camera. And I'd be like, really? It was like 2 times, 20 seconds. That's all I get? But it's on film forever. If it were up to me, I'd still be there doing it, because I love horses so much. And I was lucky here to have a good relationship with my horse. I call it a fringe benefit. It was better than riding side saddle, and much better than in Lonesome Dove, where I was in a corset and a petticoat, or on Catalani and Little Britches. There, I was the third person on the horse with Amanda Plummer and John Savage. I was the sucker who was stuck on the withers. Let me tell you, it's no fun to ride in 100 degrees in Mexico down a mountain on a horse's withers. You never forget that. Questions and Answers with Kevin Costner. The Oscar winner holds forth about playing a wary but supportive retired sheriff in Let Him Go. More often than not, a lot more often, really, Kevin Costner effortlessly assumes the take-charge role in any film or TV scenario. Whether he's mentoring an undisciplined baseball rookie in Bull Durham, or proving himself worthy of acceptance as a fellow warrior by a Sioux tribe, Dances with Wolves, or authoritatively exerting mastery of his land and legacy as a modern-day Montana cattle rancher, Yellowstone. There's rarely any doubt about who's at the wheel when it comes to driving the plot. But in Let Him Go, the suspenseful drama written and directed by Thomas Bershuda, and based on the novel by Larry Watson, Costner is less a resolutely decisive leader than a reluctantly led partner. Specifically, he plays George Blackledge, a retired sheriff turned rancher in 1950s Montana, who joins Margaret, Diane Lane, his strong-willed wife, on a perilous journey to the Dakotas to retrieve their young grandson, who has been spirited away by their late son's widow and her new husband, and taken with them to the homestead of the husband's notoriously intimidating kinfolk. "It's a real dilemma for me as George," Costner told CNI during a recent interview, "because I see what could be the outcome of her decision to go after them. And it scares me because I love my wife too much to let her be in harm's way alone. But I know there's enough danger there to take us all down." Also covered in our conversation, what was there that attracted you to Let Him Go? I think it was that early on I saw this as a thing where you realize that sometimes you have to go down this path with someone you love so much to do something that they're compelled to do, and you know it's wrong. Everything in your body is saying it's wrong. Everything in your mind, your experience, is saying this is wrong. You understand emotionally why she's doing it, but at the end, the logic of human behavior is abandoned. I mean, she doesn't feel she's being irrational. She's just being driven by love. Her grandson, this young life, is not going to be in the right hands. And there's me sitting on the other side saying, sometimes being right doesn't matter. And then it ends up destroying their life. I think sometimes men do end up following their women. If women aren't careful, they can drag their men into various serious things. It may not be immediately apparent while you're immersed in the movie, But wouldn't you agree that when you replay it in your mind afterwards, you might see that Margaret has a lot in common with Blanche, the head of the family that gains control of your grandchild? Their wills, their desires, their sense of protectiveness on purpose or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, they could be put in the same bucket, but they're separated wildly by their ethics and morals. There's no indication that George is or ever has been a weak man. Indeed, he's a retired sheriff, so he's likely no stranger to violence or dangerous situations. And that probably makes him even more aware of the risk he and Margaret are taking when they try to retrieve their grandchild. There's not any guy who wouldn't know this is a bad situation. And yet, she doesn't know or want to know what she's doing. She's going to get her man into a fight with people that fight to the death. That's what she's doing. It's like the first time I watched Moby Dick. I was young, and that movie scared me. And I didn't know why it scared me. And then somebody said the word to me, "This guy was obsessed." And I said, "What's obsession?" And I was told it's a willingness to take everybody down because of your own position. Ahab wanted that whale so badly that he put his crew in this position. He didn't care anymore. I'm not saying that Margaret doesn't care anymore, but she's obsessed. I think that's going to spur a little bit of discussion for men and women who watch. Maybe while they're driving home, or if they don't see it in a theater, maybe in their living room. Wherever they are, they'll go, "Didn't she see? He knew right away where this was going, where it could go. Why didn't she see?" You and Diane Lane were well-matched and thoroughly persuasive as Superman's adoptive parents, Jonathan and Martha Kent, in Man of Steel. But you're even more compelling together here because the threat is more realistic and the mortal stakes are much higher. Did you have much rehearsal time to work out backstories for your characters? Oh, yes. She's a very good rehearsal partner, and she's a really good partner on the set, too. She's just very supportive of other people, and she's protective of the process. She knows how to stand up for herself, and she knows that there's people standing up with her. And she loves to act. She's one of our great actresses. There's no question about it. She is one of five in the world. And yet, to a large degree, she's underrated. It's almost as though every few years people have to rediscover how great she is all over again. Well, that's because she takes on roles and assimilates into them, and that forces people to re-examine her. She's not a person who is built to repeat herself. She understands that we all have to do that to a certain extent, but she is really gifted, and she's still a romantic leading woman. She can play a grandma, but she doesn't need to. What I mean is, she can play the grandma in one film, but she still can be a romantic woman in another screenplay. She can take on that persona, too. That's not easy. She's just great. And better still, as this movie proves, she can ride a horse. Yeah, she got up there and did it. In the bunkhouse with Red Steagall, talking with Gary Dunshee of Big Bend Saddlery in Alpine, Texas. Red: "Gary, I want to talk about how you got started in the leatherwork business." Gary Dunshee: "Well, I grew up in Tucumcari, New Mexico, and did leatherwork in shop class, things like that. And whenever I left and went to college, I went up to Goodwell, Oklahoma, to Panhandle State. I'd bought an old beat-up trailer house that had been wrecked on Highway 66 in Tucumcari, and I taped some cardboard in the broken windows. My dad hauled me up there and pulled it over a sewer hole in the trailer parking lot there at Goodwell, bought me a hamburger, and took me back to my little house and pulled his wallet out. And I thought, well, I've heard about this deal. This is where it gets good. He pulled out a $5 bill and handed it to me and said, 'Good luck,' and turned around and drove off. So I kind of needed an income, and I went to making belts and holsters and things like that that I knew how to do. It was a pretty good market there, just amongst the other kids at school and people who would hear about it, and they'd get me to make them belts. And then a boy from Grady, New Mexico, taught me how to make filigree belts with a different colored background. I got to doing that, and, well, I could knock out a home run with them because I could get 25 bucks for those. Didn't take me 2 or 3 days to make one. So were you doing that in your trailer home? The last year I was there, I moved out of my trailer house and with a good friend, Jack Hall from Pritchett, Colorado, into a bigger, more spacious place right next to the railroad tracks. And that was really some palatial living there. We had dividers up to separate the front room to make a bedroom and a living room out of it. In the first week I was there, I woke up in the night. Jack's sitting up in his bed with a .22 shooting mice as they run along the baseboard. It was quite a place to live. Then I moved down here to Alpine. I made a trip or two down here with some friends from college, and I just fell in love with the country and the mountains, the people, everything. Whenever I got here, I just couldn't do but one thing. That was work leather. So I went straight to the saddle shop and was fortunate they'd just lost a helper. So I hired on as a stamp hand in 1971. George Nix, the gentleman I worked for, I guess he decided I was going to stay around, and he taught me how to carve a belt freehand without using patterns. I got to where I could carve one in about an hour. They weren't real beautiful or anything, but they were $7.50 a belt.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jeff.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the coronavirus update at 1.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 86 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
The Little Old Lady Who Broke All the Rules by Katerina Engelmann Sundbay, read by Patience Tomlinson. Chapter 25. Chief Inspector Pettersson found it incomprehensible. Two valuable paintings had been stolen from the National Museum, and although the police had set up roadblocks, checked all the passengers on trains and planes, and contacted various car hire firms, they had no leads. There were no witnesses at the museum either. Of course, that couldn't be right. The thieves couldn't simply have gone up in smoke. They had obviously escaped in a car before the museum staff had realised that the paintings had been stolen. He had heard that museum staff don't always realise the value of what they have in their collections. Chief Inspector Pattison was a middle-aged man in his prime, but with a melancholy frame of mind. The case seemed hopeless. He had no idea at all as to how the art theft could be solved. He knew everything about weapons, ammunition, car chases and blackmail attempts. But this? The police hadn't even gotten any tips from the underworld. The informants they had contacted had not heard a thing.
"There must be several years' planning behind this," said his colleague, Rolf Strömbeck, a bearded man of upper middle age, as he sorted the papers on his desk. "Imagine getting away without leaving any tracks or other leads. We don't have fingerprints, and we can't see anyone suspicious on the pictures from the surveillance cameras either. I just don't understand this." The camera that covered the room with the French Impressionists was not on. The thieves had pulled out the plug.
Pettersson sighed.
Let's go and get a cup of coffee.
The two men got up, and then